Welcome, everybody. Class 2, Introduction to Tantra. So this is our in-depth course. We're kind of doing a overview of Tibetan Buddhism in the first few classes, and then we'll delve into more of the details of the tantric approach, which also includes all of the other teachings within Buddhism, but has this particular, the method is different. Since last week, last week I said, okay, we're going to have a look at the qualities of a teacher and the qualities of a student this week. And so since last week to this week, our precious guru has departed this planet. Just like that. And how many of us thought that would happen? So beautiful returns, prayers for the swift return of Lama Dzogchen Rinpoche have just come out, and I've got copies for you here. But one of them, by the 11th Lelong Rinpoche, the very first verse says, "The lamp of the Geden teachings, the supreme refuge, Lama Dzogchen, has departed in order to rouse to the Dharma disciples who cling to permanence." So let's absorb that teaching. What we've already covered in our class, a little brief overview of the lesser and greater vehicles and the differences between them. So we had a look at the Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana. And the thing is that they're not separate paths. It's like from the point of view of Vajrayana, it has practices in common with the Mahayana and practices in common with the Hinayana. Solinus likes to call them the Pali tradition and the Sanskrit tradition. And so the view is the same, because that's what makes a Buddhist. But it's the approach that's different. So whether we're just on our individual bicycle, pedaling along to enlightenment, up and hill, uphill, down dale, being kind to everyone along the way, practicing non-harm, non-hatred, non-attachment, whether we're in the great vehicle, we're on the bus and we've got everybody with us, and we've got that power and strength and gusto to drive that bus for the benefit of everyone, looking after everybody, taking responsibility. Or whether we're on the rocket ship, the lightning vehicle, to get there the quickest. Then we had a look at the six names of Tantra. So does anyone remember what they are?
Mr.
That's right.
Vajra.
Mr. Vajra. So what's the Mr. stand for? Was true. It was actually
method.
M
method and
M and R for Mr.
Mantra.
Mantra. That's right. Mantra. So mantra, mind protection. That's one. What about Vajra? What was that? Let's stand for. Huh? No. So the diamond thunderbolt, what's that a metaphor for? Indestructible mind, the indestructible purity of the mind, because it's not that we change our mind out for an enlightened one. Our mind is by nature pure, by nature empty. So that is indestructible. So it's this continuity of that. It's just removing all of the clouds, the negativities. Okay, so we've done mantra, we've done vajra, secret. Secret, so as, why?
And harm himself?
Yeah, that's right. So to protect from harm, so that it doesn't get into the wrong hands, so it's not misunderstood, and so that we don't use tantric methods to increase our delusions. Just think California. Or, oh my gosh, I don't even want to think about the online world. But and then the methods employing all of the all of our characteristics and personality, the energy from all of the emotions and feelings that we have, and very complex and highly sophisticated methods to harness our body-mind complex to become a Buddha really fast. And you remember the canon of the Vijayadharas? So we receive the blessings of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So we proceed really quickly. So today we're going to look at, ladies and gentlemen, are we ready? On your marks. How do we know if we're ready for Tantra? How do we actually know? Or another way to put it is, what are we going to regret at the time of our death? So from last week to this week, do we have any regrets from our precious guru passing from this world? You know, I was thinking the times when Rinpoche taught in Bendigo and people said to me, oh, no, I'll go next time. Yeah, and so we have that grasping at permanence kind of thing. So on one hand, we're like, am I ready? And on the other hand is, can I afford to wait? So how do we make the decision is actually the real question. What are we basing our decision on? How do we drive the Vajra vehicle safely? So how would we drive any vehicle safely? We need some training and we need some really good road rules to keep us safe. What we're also looking at is how we can recognise a qualified teacher. So this is also so very pertinent at this time in our lives right now. So when we're in this Vajra vehicle, the question is how do we drive the Vajra vehicle safely? Are we a drunk driver is the thing. Are we driving under the influence of our disturbing emotions, or are we driving motivated by, as Geshe Saltram has been saying, you know, with the three higher trainings, ethical discipline, foundation, and then concentration of wisdom, unified. So who's the driver is the question. I just think back in my life, you know, for the first 15 years or so that I would have been allowed to go for my license, thank goodness I never did, and I knew that I shouldn't because I was a drunk and I was the kind of person that would get in the car, being off my brain, and tell everybody just drive faster. Thank goodness I never learned to drive. So there was something, you know, in me that I knew I had to protect everybody from this. So the same with our emotions, who's driving our life? And then once we get that together and then we start the search, then how can we tell who's qualified? And what do we base that decision on as well? Is that just based on charisma or is it based on checking? What's our criteria? So very big questions today, how to tell if we're ready. Does anyone have this question? Am I ready for Tantra? Yeah? Anyone know the answer yet for themselves?
I feel like I'm ready for the answer. I don't know.
Oh, you're ready for the answer?
I'm ready for the answer. I'm ready to figure it out.
Okay, so let's adjust our motivation. So we have a Mahayana motivation. It's not just for us. It's for everybody because we really, on a deep, fundamental level, recognize we are one, others are many. And just like we don't want any suffering and yearn for happiness, it's the same for every single living. regardless of the apparent differences. It's so easy to fixate on differences, but you know, underneath the skin we're all the same, and even depending which body we find ourselves, we're all the same in this yearning for safety and happiness, connection and meaning. So we take that understanding and we recognize this is for everybody, and not only that, it's our responsibility to care for everyone and look after them and help them. And so for this reason, we're doing this class and we're investigating these questions so that we can make a very informed decision, the best one for sentient beings. So we can think of Shakyamuni Buddha there, always with us, but now coming into our consciousness as a body of light there in front of us. And we take refuge on behalf of all of the sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dhamma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dhamma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dhamma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings.
Second in prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and I rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cycle existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment.
The mandala offering, to generate the stores of merit that we need to be able to focus our mind and achieve realization.
This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Randa Mandala Kamriyatayami.
Okay, so the foundation of Tantra. So those of you with the notes, you'll find this on Mind Map 3, a slightly more kind of a complex version. But for our purposes, what we have, when we hear the word Tantra, it's not just Buddhist. Tantra is across many religions, practices. So there's Hindu Tantra from the Vedic system you'll be aware of. There's also tantric practices with the Sikh tradition and with some of the esoteric Jewish traditions, and probably some Arabic ones too, I'm not sure. But because working with those subtle energies of the body, it's not unique to Buddhism. So Tantra already existed at the time of the Buddha, but it was within the Hindu system. So the view of the Hindu system is the peak of samsara. So highly ethical, but still within samsara. And so Buddha taught the tantric practices on the foundation of the three principal aspects of the path. So from a Buddhist point of view, with the goal being Buddhahood, for the benefit of all sentient beings. So a completely different goal from any of the other religions. So it's just like we have a car, where are we going with it? We all have a car, but which direction are we going off? That's really going to determine how beneficial that car is. Are we going to drive off a cliff, or are we going to get to our destination for the benefit of everybody?
Yeah. Anthea had a question.
Yeah.
Anthea asked, is it called Tantra in all those different traditions, or does it go by different names?
In the Hindu tradition, it's called Tantra, and in the others, I'm not sure. Don't know. You might have heard of, like, Kundalini yoga. That's also both in the Buddhist tradition and the Hindu tradition and the Californian abomination. So they all manipulate the subtle energies of the body. So it's like the machine. The body is the same machine, but what we do with it and why, that's what changes. So the Buddha taught Tantra to harness this machine to get us to enlightenment quickly. But like a rocket ship, it's highly complex. And like rocket ships, it can explode and cause damage. So we need to be careful and trained. So what we have with the three principal aspects of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view. So we'll go into those in a moment. Geshe Thachi Sering, who taught here for about 18 years, always said, if you're unsure, be cautious. When it comes to Tantra, be cautious. It's like using heavy machinery. You know, if you've got your whatever medication, do not use heavy machinery. Like, there's a reason for that, to be cautious. So not everything. You could probably use scissors, no worries. But, you know, operating heavy machinery, you want to be careful. So what I found quite surprising when it was put that way was that Tantra, the tantric practices are not by nature virtuous. They're not naturally virtuous, not naturally good. They won't naturally result in benefit. So what makes them virtuous is this foundation of the three principal aspects of the path. And without these three principal aspects of the path, then it's, from a Buddhist point of view, it'd be like pseudo-tantra. That's why we have to find out about it. And then actually, the stronger our three principal aspects of the path, our understanding of that, and of course the very best is to have uncontrived realizations, then the stronger our tantric practice. And for a long time, kind of in my mind, I thought, oh, yeah, the three principal aspects of the path support our tantric practice, but actually it's the other way around. Our tantric practice supports the three principal aspects of the path. That's the main focus, the three principal aspects of the path, because that's what makes it Buddhist. That's what's going to get us to the goal. And the tantric practice is what supports those. So I have a reading here from Reginald A. Ray, Secret of the Vajra World. Just puts things quite simply. The Hinayana teaching on suffering provides a particularly important protection for the tantric practitioner. Through Hinayana practice, one has come to realize that any attempts to build up and fortify ego will eventually lead to further suffering. Without this understanding, one will still believe that egoic happiness can be attained. Vajrayana practice will then be seen as a way to serve oneself in some way. In such a case, the tantric disciplines will be used to try to build up and fortify one's ego. And such is the way of the demon Rudra, a mythical being in Tibetan Buddhism who symbolizes the tantric egomaniac. A possibility that remains active within every tantric practitioner. So the tantric egomaniac is what happens if you don't have a strong foundation of the three principal aspects of the path, that you know you don't know exactly why you're doing this and that it's from this altruistic approach. So let's have a look a little bit more now in depth on those three principal aspects. So renunciation. What's renunciation? Eddie started calling this ultimate self-care. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ultimate self-care. So we're striving to for liberation. So it's not just ordinary happiness, but the complete freedom from suffering. So it means we're striving for to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Because everybody strives to be free of suffering. Hardly anyone strives to be free of the causes of it. I mean, the evidence of this is if you've had a hangover more than once, you know, we should have learned the first time. I can tell you it took me like 15 years to learn that one. So the moment we start striving to be free of the causes of suffering as well, then we're on our way. So that's what renunciation is. We're striving for freedom from the entire cycle, the ups and downs. And we're not content just with what's called contaminated happiness, so unstable happiness. The kind of happiness that, you know, we get, you know, temporary pleasures and relief from distractions and things in samsara, but we have to keep chasing it all the time. It always wears off, it always changes. And many times we're like, is that it? Like, that really didn't rock my world very much. So we start looking within our own mind and this real understanding of not wanting anything to do with contaminated happiness, really going for the main one, the complete freedom from the cycle of dissatisfaction and grasping. That is what protects us from being bound tighter to samsara, or protects us from, what would you say, from corrupting or degenerating our practice. So here's a little bit from Lama Geshe, The Essence of Tibetan Buddhism, which is a book on these three principal aspects of the path. So according to the Buddhist point of view, monks and nuns are supposed to hold renunciation vows. The meaning of monks and nuns renouncing the world is that they have less craving for and grasping at sense objects. But you cannot say that they've already given up samsara, the cycle of existence, because monks and nuns still have stomachs. The thing is that the English word renounce is linguistically tricky. You can say that monks and nuns renounce their stomachs, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they actually throw their stomachs away. So I want you to understand that renouncing sensory pleasure doesn't mean throwing nice things away. Even if you do, it doesn't mean that you renounce them. Renunciation is a totally inner experience. Renunciation of samsara doesn't mean that you throw samsara away, because your body, your nose are samsara. How can you throw your nose away? Your mind and body are samsara. Cannot throw them away. Therefore, renunciation actually means less craving. It means being more reasonable instead of putting too much psychological pressure on yourself. So it's an interesting take, isn't it? I think a really good example about this is, does anyone have a dietary allergy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but chili. Yes.
Chili, capsicum, okay. So do you eat the thing that...
Oh, occasionally.
Occasionally.
And then you suffer.
And then you suffer, yeah. And then you remember for a while. So you're renouncing the cause of your suffering. How do you go with it, Sue?
I don't touch it.
You don't touch it. Excellent. Because that's right, you're not focusing on, oh, craving, you're remembering, oh, my God, my whole face blows up like a balloon. That's right. So that's it. That's a little tiny bit of renunciation right there, where you've got the whole story. Whereas me, when I was a child, I loved toasted cheese sandwiches. Just absolutely adored them. But every time I ate them, I'd throw up. So the only time that I was allowed to eat them was my father would take me to visit someone. It was a really posh house, and they had this amazing waffle thingy, toasted sandwich machine. Make these amazing, so they say, would you like sandwiches? I go, oh, yes, goody, goody. We'd have the amazing toasted cheese sandwich, and then we'd drive home, and halfway on the drive home, I'd throw up all over the back seat. And it'd, like, happen every single time. I couldn't put it together. I just couldn't. I couldn't put the two events together. So it takes a long time for us to be able to do that, and the only way we can do that is if we change our focus away from focusing on what we're craving from our senses to really looking at the nature of that experience, how long it lasts for. His Holiness the Dalai Lama calls this kind of the pleasure and satisfaction that we get from the senses is the kind of, instead of calling it happiness, he calls it the suffering we run towards. Mm-hmm. Because it changes like that. And, you know, if while I was eating the sandwich I knew I was going to throw up, no worries. But the fact that it comes as a surprise every single time, that's the problem, isn't it? And then we go, you gave me sandwiches, it's your fault. Yeah.
Could you talk about the guard against distractions?
Oh, yes. So if we don't have a genuine experience of renunciation, then if we sit in meditation and have a nice experience, we're going to start grasping after that and to sit down in meditation and chase another nice experience. And now suddenly we've corrupted all of our good intentions. They're just gone. It's so easy to do. That nice experience is a side effect of doing a good meditation. So if we have a nice experience, we should be thinking, great, I'm gonna buckle down and meditate even harder. But if we start going, oh, I want that nice experience, then it's probably better that way than to just, you know, have it from eating chocolate or drinking gallons of vodka. But it's not going to help us achieve liberation or enlightenment. So it's not a bad thing, but it's not our goal. So we really need that. This is like number one. You can see how easy it is to derail. And then not only that, then we have bodhicitta, so that our the whole purpose of our practice is this yearning to free all beings from suffering and bring them to a state of bliss, to bring them out of suffering into a state of lasting happiness. And it's because we find the suffering of others unbearable. So instead of just when it's all about me, just going, oh, I don't want to hear about it. Suffering of others is unbearable to me. I don't want to hear about it. We look and we go, this cannot stand. Someone has to do something. Oh, my God, it's who? Me. But I'm not ready. Doesn't matter. So we have this within us. Because so many times we hear on the news someone has run into a burning house to save people. And then afterwards in the news they'll just say, I'm just an ordinary person. Anybody would have done it. But what that's really showing is this fundamental good human nature that we have, that on a neutral state we see someone suffering, we'll dive in to help them. So it's in us. So this is what we cultivate into bodhicitta, which is a real determination to find the quickest way to help others. So with bodhicitta, of course, there's no danger in this. There's no danger in developing infinite loving kindness for others, infinite compassion for others. But what the danger here without bodhicitta is then we just become like a solitary realizer. It's you know, just one's own liberation, forget about others. So the danger here, when they say the free me from, you know, the fears of samsara and nirvana, this is the danger here, that we achieve our own peace and we forget about others. And then correct view is what makes a Buddhist. So it's the view, the understanding of the nature of oneself and the nature of phenomena. And this view cuts the very root of suffering. So we don't have to weed out every single disturbing emotion one by one. 84,000 remedies for the 84,000 delusions. You can do some of them in a job lot.
Okay.
But still, no wonder it takes three countless brain eons. So what if we just cut them all off at the root? Once. Gone. So the view of the non-inherently existing I feels like we inherently exist. It feels like we're real and true, but that's not true. So this incredibly nuanced and complex understanding of reality, infinitely more than even quantum physics, because it's about the nature of our mind, our very experience. This is what makes it Buddhist, and this is what is unique about it. So we could probably call this mind science. And what we do from this kind of perspective is that we're recognizing our innate potential, which is Buddhahood. That's our actual potential. Because of the nature of our mind, the nature of our mind is no different from the mind of a Buddha. The nature is the same. So because of that, then why wouldn't we work to become a Buddha? It's the best way that we're going to be able to help all sentient beings. And then the more that we understand dependent arising, the more confidence we have. So, again, Lamyashi, what does he say here? Look at Western society. The biggest problem in the West is attachment. It's so simple. From birth through school and up to professorship or whatever one achieves, the Western life is built by attachment. Because it's not only the Western life. Attachment characterizes the life of each and every sentient being. But why I'm singling out the West is because Westerners sometimes have funny ideas about the connotation of happiness and suffering. Philosophically, of course, you can research shunyata, wisdom realizing emptiness, very deeply. You can analyze the notion of the self-existent I in a thousand ways. But here I'm talking about what you can do practically every day, right now, in a simple way. Don't think about Buddhist terminology. Don't think about what the books say or anything like that. Just ask yourself simply, how at this moment do I interpret myself? That's all. Each time you ask yourself that question, you get a different answer. Because sometimes you're emanating as a chicken, sometimes as a pig, sometimes as a monkey mind. And then you can laugh at yourself. Oh, what I'm thinking is incredible. I'm a pig. But you shouldn't worry when you see yourself as a pig. Don't worry. Just laugh. The way you check, the way you question yourself should just make you laugh. In that way, you get closer to shunyata. Because you know something? Through your own experience, you know that your own projection of yourself is a fantasy. And to some extent, you experience selflessness. You no longer trust your own ego and your concepts become less concrete. It's very practical, Lamyashi. Like, how to get started right now? Just ask yourself, how do I interpret myself at this moment? And just right there, you put a different distance between totally identifying with your emotion and awareness of it. So you're not believing it 100%. So how this applies to the Vajra vehicle, how to drive the Vajra vehicle safely. Let's read this first. So when it comes to renunciation, like I mentioned at the beginning, if we have renunciation, then it means that we're not driving under the influence of the afflictions. We're not driving our life. Our life isn't driven by the afflictive emotions or the afflictive views. So we're not grasping at all the pleasant experiences to the extent that sometimes, you know, I've even heard, for instance, people are meditating at home, they're having such a great meditation at home, and then the family comes home, it's like, well, you kids, shut up, I'm trying to meditate on peace.
I would never do that.
Hang on a second. I'm like, no, sorry, I can't talk now, I can't do anything, I'm busy studying the Dharma. Like, it's totally back to front, isn't it? Yeah.
Hello, I'm Lydia.
Hello, welcome. I think we've all had an experience like that too. So the thing is to catch ourselves doing it. And so if we haven't set our motivation at the beginning, those experiences will trip us. So it's really important at the beginning to set our motivation. Who is this for? It's not for me. It's for everybody. And then there's no way. Everybody includes the family coming home being noisy. So then they come home and it just strengthens your bodhicitta motivation even more. Ah, yes, it's these ones too that I'm doing this for. So the other thing too about renunciation is that just like there's various kind of rules for driving and, you know, you're not allowed to drive under the influence, that means that because when we're drunk, we are foolhardy. We do overestimate our skills. And so what happens if we don't really guard our own mind, when we sit down to meditate, we may be completely overwhelmed or distracted. We might have visions of our past lives. We might get all excited about future plans. Like all of this stuff comes flooding in when we create some space. So how to not get distracted? It's very important. The other thing too is that with renunciation, then when things get difficult, we won't just drop it all. I've got the flu. I can't possibly meditate. You know, I'm too tired. I'm too stressed now. Can't possibly meditate. No, I'll work on my patience later. So this is the thing. If we had renunciation, then the more difficult things got, the more we go, great, use this. Because often we're in danger of being what I'd think of as like a fair-weather Buddhist, which is what many of the lamas have said about Westerners, that when things are going well, we study really hard, we come to class, we're really happy about it all. Then when we get stressed, tired, we lose our health, have a divorce or something, we stop. And actually, that's the exact time that we need the Dharma. That's actually what we've been doing all of the study for, is when things go wrong, to apply the Dharma even more. So otherwise it's kind of like fair weather Buddhism, which is actually very, it's a very worldly way of approaching Buddhism. It's just like everything else. You know, we just, you know, we add it to our life to make our own life nicer. And then when it's inconvenient, then we drop it. So that won't change anything in our heart. And this I find quite sobering, because you can be involved in Buddhism for years and years and it not change you. And this is why. Because it's just like a fair weather Buddhism. And all those years of study and yet no result. The other thing about renunciation and not driving under the influence, that's really important to remember, years ago now, Rachel asked this fantastic question of, oh, so, okay, you know, we're in the sutra path, we're trying to counter our desires and counter our attachment, But so if that doesn't work, can we use our attachment on the tantric path? I thought, that is a brilliant question, because whether anyone says it or not, that's kind of what we're thinking. Oh, it's too hard to counter attachment. Let's use it. But actually, it's the other way around. It's like if we can't counter our attachment now, we can't harness our attachment now, there is no way we're going to be able to use it. So we have to already have that strength of the ethical discipline and of being able to completely pacify our attachment and our anger. We can't do that now on the sutra path. There is no way we can do it with the tantric approach. And so that's why renunciation, ultimate self-care, is there. Bodhicitta, so this is like the big bus. Bodhicitta, the responsibility to all of our passengers. And we know where we're going. We're taking them all with us. We're never giving up on others. And I like the idea of taking the high road, not the low road. So you're taking everybody with you, never giving up. Correct view. So this has got quite a few aspects in it, but one of them is this Lamyeshi approach of really questioning how we interpret ourselves right now. Do we hold on to this narrow view of reality? Do we believe our senses? So the road rules are there not because the rules are inherently good. Each country has different rules, don't they? Was it you who were saying you were driving in Rome? Or someone was saying just the other day? Someone gave
me... I think it was Pauline.
Oh, Pauline, that's right. So we're going because the GPS just went bananas. And we're going left, but then we realised we had to go right. So Pauline's like coming across this traffic island and things like that, and we're blocking how many rows of traffic. And she's just waving and smiling. Everyone's fine with it. She's like, if we're in Italy, this would be no problem.
We're in Rome.
Everybody would understand. She'd say, actually, even if we're in Sydney, everyone will understand. So, you know, each place has a different culture. The rules are kind of there to help us. Some rules are different in some countries than others, and they all work. So the rules aren't inherently right or wrong. They all depend. And when we're there on the road, our safety depends on others and others' safety depends on us. It's a two-way thing. And so it's not that we go into the traffic separately. We actually make the traffic as we go through it by how we drive. Same with our life. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is the actually understanding this machinery, body-mind complex, how to maintain it, how it works, and being able to be our own mechanic and being able to refuel our car so that we can maintain this Vajra vehicle and use it all the way to enlightenment. Probably the thing to remember about the correct view and our senses is that we believe what we see all the time unquestioningly because we're just so used to it. But even from a scientific point of view, even just from the a materialistic point of view, none of it exists like that. And we know this. We learn this as kids in school. You know, when you're looking at something, you're looking at blue of the altar or the blue of the sky, it's not that there's blue here and I'm, you know, blue over there and I'm here. It's like all the photons, right? The photons are coming along and then they're coming through space and they bang into our eyeball. And then our eyeball sends this electrical message to our brain. And our brain gets an image and it turns it up the right way, right? It turns it around, remember? Everything that we see is upside down. Our brain turns it around that way. And then our eye sense consciousness understands it. And we go, oh, it's Susie and Sue and Susan. So where are you? How do I know? Like, so the photons, it's the photons that are banging my eyeballs. So you might say, oh, okay, well, you're over there. If I stood up and I went over and I touched you, there you are. But how does touch work? Touch is actually, I think it's called the weak gravitational force. I can't remember. It's either the weak or the strong gravitational force. That when you touch an object, the harder it is because the stronger that force is repelling your hand. You never actually touch anything. What you're feeling, the hardness, is the repelling force. There's no way ever in the known universe I will be able to physically touch you, even though that's what it feels like. So we know this from science, right? It's completely deconstructed from science. So Buddhism takes this a step further and takes that principle and looks at the same principle with our mind, how our emotions function. There is no inherent reality. It all depends. And because of that, what kind of reality are we going to create? What kind of reality is the one most beneficial for sentient beings? Okay, so that's the little synopsis of the three principal aspects of the path. What questions do you have about that as it relates? Yes. Good. That's a Zen moment.
I recently, well,
I love Nietzsche.
Yeah, I just finished. And he said, and he recommends that we basically,
Well, he had a similar view, but he couldn't say he's a Buddhist because he didn't know what to do with the view.
Yes, and he suggested that every man should become a superman.
Yeah, that's right. And there is a parallel with that. So Nietzsche's idea of the Übermensch, the superman, is similar to the Buddhist tantric approach of seeing all beings as gods and goddesses, as Dharmas and Dakinis, as enlightened beings now, taking the future result into the present.
Well, he feared that nihilism have a next decades.
Yes, and that's what happens in the West when you have this analysis of reality go too far from existentialism to nihilism. And deconstructing everything and not knowing what to do with it ends up with nihilism. And that's because it's coming from a materialistic point of view. So if you're a materialist, it'll never work out. The only possible place that you can end up with the analysis is being a nihilist. So, of course, they all went, you know, got suicidal, killed themselves or else became highly religious on their deathbeds. But what, from the Buddhist point of view, what Lama Tsongkhapa did was he did the analysis and then he came back to the middle way. And that's really the most fine, most unique teachings. So you've got to find Lama Tsongkhapa's middle way as your next chapter. So, any other questions on the three principal aspects? Are we going? Does it make sense? Am I putting the case well? All right. So, this is, all these of a student, a couple of things. So one is the three faults to abandon. So I just threw this in because I personally found this really helpful. This is for both Sutra and Tantra. We abandon these faults when you abandon the six attitudes. But basically, especially when you first come to Buddhism, these three faults of approach can get us into a lot of trouble. We don't know that they're happening. So the upside down vessel, the most obvious example of that is come to teachings, you fall asleep. You sit down and meditate, you fall asleep. You know, you watch a video of the Dalai Lama on the telly, you fall asleep. So that's it. That's like the cup's upside down. Good intentions, nothing's going. Fair enough. But there is a more subtle version of this, which is if you're here reluctantly, you're one of the cranky husbands brought by the wives, or you're here because you think you should be, or you're one of the school students that come and like half of them are really interested to come to the temple. The others are like, oh, I just want to go, right? So if you're reluctantly here, you're not going to be open-minded. You won't be able to get anything. There's no joy in discovery. Also, if you come from a strong academic background, you might be here kind of like with a bit of an arrogant approach. And if you come from also like from a Western our society, it's deeply materialistic. And so there's an incredible arrogance in materialism as if it's the only worldview, and yet there's not a skerrick of evidence to support it. And not only that, you know, most of us, you know, we're white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant kind of background, so there's this incredible colonialist view that we've been born into that we may not know that we have. So that's kind of one of it, is when it's quite that academic arrogance, that's being the closed, the upside down vessel. But the dirty vessel one is where we bring that kind of cultural baggage with us and we don't know that we've got it. So we don't recognize our materialistic tendencies. We don't recognize our casual racism, our colonial perspective, all of that kind of stuff. It's just kind of there. And we don't recognize our own emotional baggage as well. And so that's like the dirty cup. So if you imagine pouring your wonderful morning cup of tea or coffee into that cup, delicious, amazing, expensive tea from overseas, you pour it into that cup, and then what happens? What's it going to taste like?
Awful.
Awful. And then you're going to go, oh, that tea's no good. Give me something else, better, cheaper, more, whatever it is. And you stick that in the cup too. So this is actually the biggest problem that we have, that we'll just coast along, and then an emergency will happen in life. Someone will be on their deathbed, or some emergency will happen, and you'll go, oh, yeah, that's good, but those teachings are far too complicated. Give me something simpler. I need something simpler now. It's like, it's not a simple situation. It can't be a simple teaching. You have to have done the prep. Or we try and find equivalencies. This is the same as that. God is the same as Buddha. Sometimes there's equivalencies and sometimes there's not. If we come from a Christian culture or a culture where we have a creator God, you'll often find yourself praying to Buddha, Buddha, please fix this. Buddha, I'm putting in my request list. As if Buddha is separate from us. So we might find that we do this without even knowing, without even actually recognizing what's going on here. And also when we come across the idea of karma, for instance, we might think, oh, that doesn't sound fair. So if we have that thought about karma, we know that's not karma, that's our cultural baggage. So it's good to notice it. It's good to notice the little voice that goes, yeah, that's poor innocent babies or poor innocent lambies, or that's not fair. So once we start having those thoughts, right there, that's the dirty vessel. We've got our creative God culture being mixed with the Buddhist view without us knowing it, and those don't mix. So we have to clean it out. And the way to do this is to be really clear with definitions and don't assume that we know what attachment is just because we know the word attachment or what Buddha is just because we know the word Buddha. Because when we say Buddha, many people just think historical Buddha, which is a person, which is one quarter of what a Buddha is. So definitions is really the one to help us with the dirty vessel and to have great courage to just catch yourself. With the upside down vessel, the best thing about that is to just be curious. Really enjoy your study. Learn how to savor not knowing the answer. Instead of going, oh, I don't know anything, I'm a bad person. Was that because of the Queensland education system?
Yeah.
Was that more universal? To go, oh, I don't understand anything. How excellent. I'm going to dive right in. I can't wait. Yes.
My boss once told me that is what doesn't come in mistakes.
A man who hasn't done any mistakes hasn't done anything. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, without mistakes.
And
without
that's...
mistakes, how would we ever learn?
We don't learn. But when we do a mistake, how many of us go, fantastic, goody, goody?
I try.
That's right. Training words first. That's right. That's it. And, of course, the cracked vessel, well, that's... clearly, in one ear, out the other. So that's really a matter of just discipline and study. We can hear something, and if we're open-minded and we've kind of cleaned our mind beforehand, it'll go in, we'll go, oh, yeah, that all makes perfect sense. And then 10 minutes afterwards when we're having lunch after class and I'll go, so, Susie, what was the bit that really stuck with you today? You'll go, blank. Or someone will ask me, oh, you know, I saw you took 22 pages of notes at the retreat up at Chenrezig Institute. What did Geshe-la talk about? Can I think of one thing? Yeah, I can probably think about three things. So that's just really, it's the taking effort to review, to really apply it to your life and to integrate it into your daily life. That's the most important. So... enjoy your study, especially because there's a lot of study. In fact, Buddhahood is called the path of no more learning. So up, as Geshe Thachi Sering so often said, up until full enlightenment, we're studying. So we have to enjoy it. So if you don't enjoy your study, there is a way to learn how to enjoy it. So one is to stop trying to be perfect, to learn how to be curious, to be courageous, to enjoy discovering things, to stop being so hard on value judgment, you don't know anything, therefore you're not worth anything, all of that stuff. We really got to set it up well or we won't get there. Don't try and understand everything all at once. So just look for the... See, nice to meet you. Tell me, what was your name?
Oh, my name is I guess I'm Buddha curious.
Angus, so nice that you came along. Did you get one of the, from the, can you, Yvette, can you get Angus this book if you can to take home? And thank you so much for coming. So, yes, yeah, so don't try and understand it all at once. Just look for the one gold nugget and let that settle into your mind. Practicing slogans. So that's one of the instructions from the 7-point mind training, practicing slogans. Or, as your mummy used to say, use your words, dear. We've got to reframe everything with words first. So even Lama Zopa Rinpoche passed into the clear light and has left this world. Lama Zopa Rinpoche didn't die. Did you notice? No one said Lama Zopa Rinpoche's died unless they were being very brutal with their emotions. I heard one person say, yeah, well, he's dead. It's like, no, he's not. Lama Zopa Rinpoche can't die. Who is Lama Zopa Rinpoche? Lama Zopa Rinpoche can't die. We're thinking Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Namanakaya. So what's happened actually is a change in the physical body. So that's why they said Lama Zogchen Rinpoche is entering his final meditation, because that is technically correct. The breath has stopped. He's entering the clear light meditation. That's what's happening. So that's training in words. It's a huge difference to our mind, isn't it? And then Rinpoche's meditation is finished. He's passed out of this world. And then Kandra was requesting prayer, please come back to this world, out of all the planets and the galaxies, crying out for a bodhisattva, a Buddha, like Rinpoche, to help them. We have to cry out as loud as we possibly can to come back here. Because if we don't, he's going to go where most needed. So training in words is crucial so that we get the correct view of the reality, at least with the words first. Applying the teachings to our own situation, always personally our situation before we get all academic about stuff. If we get all academic first and don't apply it, we'll become dry, brutal, cranky old Buddhists. And Socratic questioning. Does anyone know what that is?
Analytical.
It's analytical, but it's a particular way of doing it. Yes. It's very much to do with, like, Lama Tsongkhapa middle way method, the consequentialist school. If this, then this, you take it to an nth degree, so that anything that's not quite right, if you take it to its nth degree, it ends up with absurdity. Really funny, like Lama Yeshe says, you laugh. So then you get to see it in all of its ridiculousness. So the consequentialist method of questioning things is a way to do this. Another way that you could think of it, it's kind of like the Monty Python method, really. Similar approach.
Or the Google method, you know, you always end up with cancer.
Yeah. The Google method, Alison has just said, where you always end up with cancer. That's right. That's right. So there's your nth degree, the absurdity. Yeah. So this is just really in general, and already if we can bring this into our daily practice, it will make sure we get off on the right direction, and then our whole progress will be joyous no matter what happens to us. To become a student of Tantra, though, we need extra things. So that was Sutra, now Tantra. So you need to have this wish to be liberated, renunciation. So, for instance, with renunciation, when you have a problem, you don't just go, I want to get rid of the problem. You go, what's the teaching moment here? What can I learn? How can I use it to benefit others? So you don't even treat problems as bad things. Then you know you've got getting somewhere with renunciation. And that you seek to alleviate the sickness, not the symptoms. So then we're unable to bear the suffering of others without trying to help them. That's our bodhicitta. Whereas normally we just can't even see the suffering of others. Like, I can't watch those nature shows. I just can't. Because everyone's killing everybody. And if they don't, one of them will die because they'll starve. They'll starve. Like what? Like
this beautiful music.
And with all this beautiful music and slow motion.
I know, it's
why it makes something. Something
I just cannot, even for a few seconds. But it did. I did hear that Lama Zogchen Rinpoche also couldn't watch them because Venerable Roger said they were in a hotel room and the Attenborough's, you know, life on earth was on, and so Rinpoche's there peeking from behind the door going, oh, I can't watch and crying, and then going back around the door and then peeking in, oh, no, 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 no. like just completely distressed too, because Rinpoche, you know, of course, feels for everybody. So, but that, remember, that's actually an empathy response. That actually is compassion. Compassion is an action. It's a determination to help. So it goes from empathy to action. And if we just leave it at empathy, we just go, I can't watch. It's no good. So this is unable to bear the suffering of others without helping. That's the compassion part. And then what's the best way to help? To become a Buddha. That's the bodhicitta part. So already two principal aspects of the path there. Then we've got to have confidence in the Vajra master. So we must really have confidence in that teacher and know what to look for. And it's got to be a lot more than just a nice feeling, because if we don't, then we just won't be able to progress. So if you think just in the worldly life, when we, if we're looking for a coach, a life coach, or tennis players, they have an incredible tennis coach, or boxers have an amazing trainer. Like all of those elite athletes and elite musicians, elite dancers, they all have a trainer or a coach, and they talk about it. They say, oh, I was trained by so-and-so at this school, you know, and the lineage is passed down. So if you have incredible confidence in your teacher, you'll do whatever they say, and they will push you, and you will go beyond what you can expect. And if you don't, if your mind isn't in accord with your coach, doesn't matter how good they are or how good you are, you just won't progress. So we see that with worldly things, and we can see the difficulties people have with their trainers. So I think it was Tyson, you know. He had his coach right at the beginning, Mike Tyson, really looked after him like a father and a mother, housed him, fed him, emotionally picked him up and trained him, and it was fantastic. And when he died, like Mike Tyson went off the rails, never found a coach again that was so much on his side and understood him so well. So it really makes a big difference. We must have confidence in the Vajra Master. We must desire to guard our vows. That's like our road rules. We've got to really desire to be safe for oneself and others. Have confidence in Tantra, in the tantric approach. Confidence, perseverance, determination.
So, Miffy, I've got a question. I feel like I should know this, but who is the Vajra Master when you're doing Tantra? Is it
the guru?
The guru.
The tantric guru is the Vajra Master. So we'll go into that in a sec.
Oh, okay.
But so not just any old guru or teacher, the actual qualified to teach you the path of Tantra. So like a driving instructor is qualified to teach you to drive. Someone who can't drive is not qualified to teach you to drive. And someone who can drive may or may not be able to teach you. So a Vajra Master is qualified. Yeah. You must have trained in the three common preliminaries, three principal aspects of the path. So they're in common with Mahayana Sutra. And you've got to be absolutely eager and joyous to hold the commitments. So this means, I remember actually being at one initiation where people were so grasping to have that initiation because it was rare. And then they found out the commitments at the end and they're like, oh, no. It was like, why did you want the initiation? To just have it, to say I've done it? Isn't the whole reason to have the initiation is so now we can practice? So when you get commitments, it's like, fantastic, now I can practice. But just shows the level of material, what is it, spiritual materialism that we have, that we go, oh, I don't know about the commitments. It's like, Are we committed to becoming a Buddha for the benefit of all or not?
So yes. It's kind of like enrolling in a university degree, but you don't want to go to the lectures. You don't want to do the exams. You just want the title
at
the
end. That's right. Enrolling in the uni degree and not wanting to go to the lectures, do the exams, or even like pay to join the professional associations. You just
want the piece of paper.
Want the paper to hang on the wall, which you can actually just go and buy anywhere anyway. So, but
we haven't connected.
Yeah, we haven't connected anything. We're not able to do anything. So we really want to wish to meet the commitment. And then we've got a request. We have to actually request the initiation. Sometimes many, many times. It's not good enough, as we know, to just not and think, oh, I paid my money. When's it starting? Was anyone in Tasmania when Lama Zopa Rinpoche was going to give the Great Chenrezig Initiation? And so people flew from all over Australia for it. They were there, they were all having big old chin wag and catching up with everybody. And Geshe Zopa was there, and Geshe Zopa's like, we should read these sutras, we should make lots and lots of merit, you know, on the day. And no, they didn't pay any attention to Geshe Zopa. They didn't sit down and read those sutras, they just kept on having tea and chatting. So when Lama Zopa Rinpoche arrived, then he gave a teaching. But there was no initiation. And everyone was absolutely shocked that it didn't happen. And then, to make themselves feel better, they said, oh, it wasn't meant to happen. Well, no, because you didn't have the merit. You didn't create it. And what are we here for? Not for our spiritual materialism. We're here to practice, to become Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings.
And the love of the saint. Yes.
That's why I've got Chenrezig Institute. So requesting the initiation, there's the formal request, but the real request comes from our heart. Yeah. Okay, so here's from Tantra, the Foundation of Buddhist Thought by the English Geshe Thachsin Tseri, page 24. No matter what level of practice or type of Buddhism that we undertake, we need a teacher to guide us. We can learn a few things from books, but to make true progress, we need to have a relationship with a teacher who knows our propensities and can guide us skillfully. Sometimes the way Tibetan Buddhism is written about in the West assumes the student's level of involvement with the teacher is the same in all paths. But the method for teaching Mahayana is different from that used for teaching the subjects of the Hinayana path, and the difference in methodology becomes even more marked with Vajrayana, where there are unique and very important considerations that form a vital part of the practice that are not present in any of the other two paths. These very different paths seem to become conflated in books, so it's often unclear how vital the teacher-student relationship is to Vajrayana. Within Tibetan Buddhism, the teacher-student relationship is almost always discussed in the context of Vajrayana. So it's often assumed that what applies to the Vajrayana applies to the other vehicles as well. So the whole Lam Rim, for instance, is written from the point of view of Vajrayana. In Vajrayana, a student is asked to do strict mind training on how to relate to the teacher, and that's not true of all the paths. It's important to be aware of this distinction when you listen to a Lama giving teachings. Just because we receive teachings from someone doesn't necessarily mean that we should treat that person as our teacher or our guru. He or she can be seen as a spiritual friend giving a teaching in order to help us. We should have a deep respect for the teacher and the teachings, strong awareness of the kindness of the teacher, and a strong conviction to follow the advice of the teacher as best as we're able. But the relationship needn't go any further than that. Some of the Lam Rim texts emphasize the importance of finding the right teacher, establishing and keeping a pure relationship with him or her, and following their advice. Such explanations, although placed at the beginning of the text, are actually intended for a person preparing to become a tantric practitioner. So if we were on Mahayana Sutra, they'd probably be at the end of the text. But because the Lamrim is written from the tantric perspective, guru devotion comes first because it's the key. When we're ready to enter Vajrayana, these elements, finding the right teacher and maintaining a pure relationship based on seeing the teacher as pure, become vital. Although the basic structure is the same, a sense of conviction and deep respect, the ability to see the teacher's great qualities and recall his or her kindness, the relationship to the teacher giving the tantric initiations and instructions is quite different from any that we've had before. So this is the differences. So the qualities, first of just really quickly, of a master in Mahayana Sutra comes under the three, and we would have touched on this in the spiritual teacher unit, conduct, wisdom, and how to look after students. So the conduct, ethical discipline, meditative stabilization, and training in wisdom. So that's the three higher trainings. They've got to be completely skilled in that. The wisdom, at the minimum, well-versed in scripture. So giving you the right quotes and the right sources, not just making it up. At least conceptually realized emptiness. So having all of the right, correct analysis, if not having, a direct experience. And in Mahayana Sutra, the teacher must know more than the student. So this is what I take heart for, because here I am leading a class and I'm like one step ahead of you, but at least I'm one step ahead. And sometimes by the end of the class, I've shared everything I know and that's it. I'm out. I don't have one extra thing. Now you're ahead of me. So it's like it's neck and neck as we're going through this course. But this is what gives me hope. At least if I'm just one step ahead, we can keep going. But, you know, the actual master in sutra, they must know more than the student. And then how to look after students. So this is these four qualities are also what how, as a volunteer, we look after visitors. We have these four qualities. Anyone volunteering at a Dharma centre, this is what we need to do. So skilled in teaching means that we can effectively lead students. We have an engaging manner. We understand the customs, the personalities. You know, the teachers know how to crack jokes, all that kind of thing. So we have to be skilled with handling sentient beings. Motivated by love. Not motivated by money. So volunteers, not motivated by money, clearly. But it keeps us pure, doesn't it? Also not motivated by status or need for appreciation, motivated by care. And so that means even if students are rude or are disrespectful or don't like the teaching, doesn't matter, doesn't change your approach. Even if you don't get any money, you don't get any donations, you know, one centre gives this much, another centre gives nothing, doesn't matter. Content with one's work means being so enthusiastic, like Geshe Tashi Sering has taught the Lamrim for all these years, and, you know, his passion is emptiness. Just like Geshe Sherab, his passion, his absolute forte is to explain emptiness, and yet so happy to explain how to overcome attachment and over and over again without going, come on, you should know this by now. Like, content with one's work. It's really profound. And patient and tolerant. So regardless of how they're treated, whether the students are slow, whether they're rude, whether they're smart, whether they're rich, doesn't matter. Always patient, always tolerant. Whether they get stage fright and can't answer any questions. Like sometimes I think, how do those Geshis know what to say? Because they go, do you get it? Like Geshe Sherab does, and everyone just goes. I'm like, oh my. He must have to be clairvoyant to tell if this teaching is going in or not, because you're not telling by the faces. So that's just generally, okay? But then from Tantra, there's extras. This is just generally a qualified teacher. Tantra, at the very least, now the guru must have more qualities than faults. That's quite different from just no more than the student. They have to have more qualities than they have faults. They themselves have to have attained the empowerment from a qualified master, so it's an unbroken lineage. They themselves must be abiding in the vows and samayas, so they're practicing what they're preaching. They have ethical conduct. There are no double standards. If you see a double standard, something is seriously wrong. And that teacher is not suitable to be your Vajra master. Now, if you have taken someone as a guru, as a Vajra master in the tantric approach, it's crucial that we've done all of our checking up beforehand. Because once we've made that commitment, just like if we get a boxing coach or a swimming coach or a dancing coach or whatever it is, once we've made that commitment, if we question them, it's just going to harm us, isn't it? They're going to say, do this, and you're going to go, yeah, I don't want to. You're like, Miffy, do it, and then you do it, and it's like, wow, that worked. So once we've taken someone on the tantric path as our guru, there's no room for questioning anymore because it's fast. So you have to have gone through this analysis first. So you see, are they abiding in the vows and samayas? Once you've taken them as a guru, then if they appear to not being abiding in the vows and samayas, that's because it's a teaching for us. They're teaching us, and it's our negative karmic vision. It's a completely different way of looking at things. And if we just go back to an ordinary view again, it's incredibly harmful for us. So that's why we have to check first.
When you say double standards, you mean they practice what they preach?
Yes.
Yeah, but because often teachers might have many students, what might be right for one student is not the same for the other. So you're talking more about they're practicing what they're teaching.
Well, what approach for one student and approach for another can be quite different. So Lama Yeshe was so incredibly kind and gentle to some people and, like, to Venerable Rabina, incredibly wrathful. And yet, you know, he was her root guru. She never questioned his wrath. And it's the same thing, you know, for me. So Venerable Rabina is one of my teachers. And so then she shows this face of being angry at me. So I can either go, no, that's not very politically correct. And then what benefit do I get from her teachings? None. Or I can go, wow, thank you. You just showed me right where I'm up to emotionally, what matters, what doesn't. Fantastic. Now I just have a little bit of a wobble, like on my bicycle. Oh, no, I'm right. It's okay. I know what I'm doing. Thank you. I needed to know that. And so I get the benefit. So that's just on that. But when it comes to Tantra, it's even more. Learn it in the lineage rites. So they know the technicalities. Also that it's not just academics, not just university knowledge, but actual, like, lived experience. They have completed the retreat. That's the 3-year retreat. And all their commitments, including the fire puja. Then they would be permitted to pass on the practice, but they must also have permission from the deity. So, for instance, if you have a Great Chenrezig initiation, whoever is bestowing that must have had permission from Great Chenrezig. Or, at the very least, that they're not opposed by the deity. Well, is the Dalai Lama great Chenrezig? Is that technically correct? We're going to use our words.
I'd say yes, because he's the emanation of Chenrezig.
There's the word. What's the word?
Emanation.
That's right. So His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, is an emanation of Chenrezig. So we can't see, well, I can't see, you might, thousand-armed Chenrezig with all the arms with my eyeballs, but I can see a human emanation of Chenrezig. Because Chenrezig is emanating as a human, for me a human to relate to. And Chenrezig at this very moment is also emanating as a dog for the dogs to relate to, and an ant for the ants to relate to, and as a deva for all the devas to relate to, and as a human for us humans to relate to. So is the Dalai Lama Chenrezig? You'd say technically, from my point of view, my conduit vision. It's just my ordinary karmic vision that is obscuring the reality. Great Chenrezig, there in front of me. Okay, so then choosing a guru, to sum it up. This is just my opinion, okay? This is how I would sum it up. Judge your own crazy first. So first we have to check out what, from my side as a student, what's my responsibility? What do I have to get in order here? We have to be active participants here. We can't just sit back and go, oh, well, they didn't do anything for me. And we have to, make sure we've got the correct attitudes, like those three vessels, especially clean up the dirty cup. We have to look at all of the disciples of that Vajra Master and see how are they going. Are they good practitioners? Are they cranky? Are they kind? That's going to determine. We have to be clear what our expectations are. So we have to do a degree of self-reflection, which is why I call it judge your own crazy first, because otherwise it's a very infantile approach. We come into the teaching or the initiation all crazy and we expect the Lama to fix it. It's just not going to happen. And then if that's our expectation and then it doesn't happen, then we start having all of these derogatory thoughts about the Lama, and that cuts us off. That we're just cut ourselves off. So it's really worth doing this self-reflection. Then the other thing is to recognize that we are actually putting our life in their hands. So it's just like soldiers in the field, they have their captain or their major or whatever it is, their leader in their little band, and they do everything they're told. And they know that if they do that, they work harmoniously together, they save each other's lives. They don't go, oh, my commander, yeah, I'm not so sure, I don't really feel it today. They're like, you there, you there, you there, and then everybody's safe. So, and we know what happens if you have a bad commander as well. It's just like, it's terrible. But this is, it's a really good example, this one, because here we are, we're in the field of the disturbing emotions, the afflictive states of mind, and our guru is navigating us through this minefield really fast. So we have to do exactly what they say, without any doubt, and we'll be safe. So the difference here between Sutra and Tantra is that in Sutra you think of the Lama is like the Buddha, is like a representative of the Buddha, is like the emissary of the Buddha. And in Tantra, the Lama is the Buddha. It's that different. And then you get the most benefit. Then no matter what happens, it's a teaching moment. You get immeasurable benefit from it. So that's why it's so important to check first. And then how do we check? It's got to be based on analysis, not just charisma, not just how it feels right. Now, when we make decisions on if something feels right, so in Australia, all those email internet scams, there's something like $3 billion a year is lost to scams because it feels right. That's what happens when you go with your feelings, with your hopes and your yearning without checking things out. So we have to really make the analysis. You can be affected by the charisma. You can have a real feeling when you're in the presence of a holy being. Like, it's remarkable. But you have to back that up with analysis and know why and what's happening. Otherwise, it's just on the level of faith. And, you know, like there are many gurus in the world and many teachings that have a remarkable presence. So there is there's a lady, Amala, the hugging mother. And so I have a couple of friends that are devoted to her. And so she came to Australia, thousands of people there. You go up and she'd hug you and you have this blissful experience and just completely connect you. And she could do that with everybody and it was incredibly healing. And so for them, that's what they wanted. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's also not going to lead us to enlightenment. So just a nice feeling alone, even a nice, completely pure, infinitely compassionate, loving feeling alone isn't enough. And I know we've got no time, but here's a little bit from Reginald Ray. This is also about the smarts as well. So eloquence is not the most important quality of a Dharma teacher either. So eloquence, you can also think in terms of a nice presentation, a slick presentation. And when you think of some lamas, maybe they don't have such great charisma or they haven't got the nice dot points. They don't have the polish. So eloquence is not the most important quality of a Dharma teacher, for it's not so difficult to deliver a nice lecture. What's crucial is that through a genuine and profound practice of meditation, he or she maintains a direct personal experience of the teachings. Otherwise, the teacher might be like a parrot who repeats again and again, practice virtue, don't practice non-virtue, but who devours an insect as soon as it enters the cage. So we can rely on a lama who through meditation practice has removed some of the mind's obscurations, attained some degree of realization, and has developed great compassion. Teachers with a good heart have your interest, not theirs, in mind. This last point is particularly important. A genuine teacher is there to speak for our essential nature and to act on its behalf until we can learn to do so for ourselves. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so I get ears all pinned back. And I mean, you know, we go through this, the qualities of a guru, and I just think, wow, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, just all of those qualities and more. And here and now gone. It's like the planet is lighter because the heavy of virtue is just, yeah, that's right. So even, so Lama Zopa Rinpoche, because of, you know, having TB many, you know, when he was young, had this cough. And so that would be like the first hurdle to get over. Are we listening with our ears or are we listening with our mind? And so after a while, if you got all your ducks in order with your attitude, you turn the dial and you tune into the teaching. And some people go, I didn't hear one single cough. And others would go, all I could hear was the cough. So it just shows how dominated we are by our senses and how we can't just listen without ears, without, of course, consciousness. But the amazing thing was that then when Rinpoche manifested a stroke and he had to learn how to speak again, was like, even though, you know, the left hand or whichever hand, I can't remember now because it's, you know, wasn't working so well, when Rinpoche learned to speak again, it was like Rinpoche 2.0, no cough and this incredible vaudeville approach, teaching with his entire body because to get all the words out and everything, it was like this super enhanced teaching. So having to learn to speak from a different part of his voice meant that the whole habit of the cough that was physiologically there was gone. And not only that, then this incredible body language with the hands. Just Rinpoche talking about all the different ants fighting, the different ant armies coming and da-da-da-da. And you swear that his ants, his hands just manifested into the different breeds of ant. You can just see them. It's like this cartoon overlay on top of it all. It's extraordinary. So even that, what we think is a difficulty, whatever comes in the path of a holy being like that is just used to benefit sentient beings. I know, except that is a bit of a fatalistic thing because it's not that Rinpoche is weeding us out, whether we're ready or not. It's our karma. Yeah. It's our karma is weeding us out, and what's happening is we are succumbing to our karma. So either we all get it together in our mind and we get our three principal aspects of the path really clearly from our heart. But then you might have been the person. Then there's always someone at about midnight that leaves, and the moment they're gone, the initiation starts.
Yeah, I was not ready.
So, yeah. Okay, so foundation, what makes Tantra virtuous? Renunciation means we're not distracted, especially by the good times. We don't start things, Corey Jackson often says, oh, samsara is going to turn out okay after all. But it kind of means that we remember everybody, including the Trumps of this world, including, like, feeling even more concern for the Donald Trumps of this world. Correct view is actually what cuts the root of samsara. For master and disciple, so where to from here? We continue to train three principal aspects of the path. Remember that in Tantra you view the Lama as no different from the Buddha. So we have to investigate before the initiation, and the whole point of having the initiation is to hold vows joyfully. There are some readings, Samsaric Suffering, pages 29 to 32. There's a class 2 summary and mind maps 3, 4 and 5. So next week then we'll look at the three gates to enter Tantra. So what makes you a Buddhist, what makes you Mahayana, and then what makes it Tantra. And we also have our mysterious.
Yeah.
It's so fun. Me and Jordan made it up, and it really is the make or break. So let's dedicate. Gathering up all the words, things as drops of light that are lighting into your mental, into your illuminating your mind to blossom into realization. For the benefit of all beings.
Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. and as long as space endures, as long as sentient beings abide, may I to remain to dispel the sorrows of the world.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone online. Sorry, going over. I think the excuse is it's the times.